Timescape, Cassette 11.
Chapter 44, November 22, 1963. Gordon wrote out the equation in full before commenting on it. The yellow chalk squeaked. So we see that if we integrate Maxwell's equations over the volume, the flux... Movement at the back of the class caught his eye. He turned. A secretary from the department waved a hand hesitantly at him. Yes? Dr. Bernstein, I hate to interrupt, but we've just heard on the radio that the president has been shot. She said it in one long gasp. There was an answering rustle from the class. I thought you would want to know, she finished lamely. Gordon stood unmoving. Speculations raced through his mind. Then he remembered where he was and firmly put them aside. There was a lecture to finish. Very well, thank you. He studied the upturned faces of the class. I think in view of how much more material there is to cover in this semester, until something more is known, we should go on. One of the twins said abruptly, Where was he? The secretary answered meekly, In Dallas. I hope somebody gets Goldwater then, the twin said with sudden vehemence. Quiet, quiet, Gordon said mildly. There is nothing we can do here, right? I propose to continue. With that, he returned to the equation. He got through most of the introductory discussion of the pointing vector, ignoring the buzz of whispers at his back. He fell into the rhythm of the discussion. His stabs with the chalk made their clicking points one by one. The equations unfolded their beauties. He conjured up electromagnetic waves and endowed them with momentum. He spoke of imaginary mathematical boxes brimming with light, their flux kept in precise balance by the unseen power of partial differentials. Another stirring at the back of the room. Several students were leaving. Gordon put down his chalk. I suppose you can't concentrate under the circumstances, he conceded. We'll take it up next time. One of the twins got up to leave and said to the other, Lyndon Johnson. Jesus, we might end up with him. Gordon made his way down to his office and put away his lecture notes. He was tired, but he supposed he should go hunt up a TV and watch. The last week had been a madhouse of interviews, challenges by other physicists, and an astonishing amount of attention from the networks. He was thoroughly weary of the whole process. He remembered that the student center down by Scripps Beach had a TV. The drive down in his Chevy took only moments. There seemed to be few people on the streets. Students were ranked three deep around the set. As Gordon came in and stood at the back, Walter Cronkite was saying, I repeat, there is still no definite word from Parkland Memorial Hospital about the president. A priest who just left the operating room was heard to have said that the president was dying. However, that is not an official announcement. The priest did acknowledge that the last rites have been administered to the president. Gordon asked a student next to him, What happened? Some guy shot him from a school book building, they said. Cronkite accepted a piece of paper from off-camera. Governor John Connolly is undergoing treatment in the operating room next to the president. The doctors working on the governor have said only that he is in serious condition. Meanwhile, Vice President Johnson is known to be in the hospital. He is apparently waiting in a small room down the corridor from where the president lies. The Secret Service has the area completely surrounded with the help of the Dallas police. Gordon noticed several of the students from his class gathered nearby. The recreation room was packed now. The crowd was absolutely still as Cronkite paused, listening to a small headset which he pressed to his ear. Through the glass sliding doors which led out onto a wooden porch, Gordon could see the waves breaking into white and sliding up the beach. Outside, the world went on with its unending rhythm. In this small pocket, a flickering color screen held sway. Cronkite glanced off camera and then back. The Dallas police have just released the name of the man they suspect of the shooting. His name is Lee Oswald. Apparently, he is an employee of the school book depository building. That's the building that the shots, some said rifle shots, but that has not been confirmed, came from. The Dallas police have not released any further information. There are many policemen around that building now, and it is very difficult to get any information. However, we do have men on the scene, and a television camera is being set up, I am told. The recreation room was becoming hot. Fall sunlight streamed through the glass doors. Someone lit a cigarette. The plumes of smoke slowed and formed blue layers as Cronkite spoke on, repeating himself, waiting for more reports. Gordon began breathing more rapidly, as though the thickened air would not come freely into his lungs. The light became watery, weaving. The crowd around him caught the feeling and moved restlessly, human wheat beneath a strange wind. Some members of the crowd around Dealey Plaza say there were two shots fired at the presidential motorcade. There are reports of three and four shots, however. One of our reporters on the scene says the shots came from a window on the sixth story of that school book depository. The scene suddenly shifted to a bleak fall landscape in black and white. Knots of people crowded the sidewalk before a brick building. Trees stood out in stark contrast to the bright sky. The camera panned to show a bleached, open plaza. Cars blocked the streets. People milled aimlessly. "That is the site of the shooting you are seeing now," Cronkite continued. "There is still no definite word about the president. A nurse in the corridor outside has said that the doctors working on the president have carried out a tracheotomy, that is, a cut in the windpipe to make another breathing path for the president. This seems to confirm reports that Mr. Kennedy was struck in the back of the neck." Gordon felt ill. He wiped beads of sweat from his brow. He was the only person in the room wearing a jacket and tie. The air felt silky, moist. The odd sensation of a moment before was ebbing slowly away. "There is a report that Mrs. Kennedy has been seen in the corridor outside the operating room. We have no indication of what this means." Cronkite was in shirt sleeves. He looked uncertain and anxious. "Back at Dealey Plaza," again the crowds, the brick building, police everywhere. "Yes, there is a police statement that Oswald has been removed from the area under heavy police guard. We did not see them leave the school book depository building, at least not from the front entrance. Apparently they left through the back. Oswald has been inside the building since he was captured there moments after the shooting. Wait, wait." On the screen, the crowd parted. Men in overcoats and hats moved ahead of a double rank of police, pushing the crowd back. "Someone else is leaving the depository building taken by the police. Our camera crew there tells me it is another person involved in the incident, in the capture of the suspect, Lee Oswald. I think I can see him now." Between the lines of policemen marched a teenager, a boy. He looked around at the press of bodies, appearing dazed. He wore a tan leather jacket and blue jeans. He was well over 6 feet in height and looked out over the heads of the policemen. His head swiveled around, taking it all in. He had brown hair and wore glasses that reflected the glaring, slanted sunlight. His head stopped when he saw the camera. A figure moved into the foreground, holding a microphone. The police surged to block him. Distantly, "If we could just have a statement, I..." A plainclothesman leading the group shook his head. "Nothing until later, when..." "Hey! Hold on!" It was the teenager in a loud, booming voice that stopped everyone. The plainclothesman, a hand raised, palm forward toward the camera, looked back over his shoulder. "You cops have bugged me enough," the boy said. He shouldered his way forward. The policeman yielded before him and concentrated on keeping the crowd back. He reached the plainclothesman. "Look, am I under arrest or what?" "Well, no, you're under protective custody." "Okay, that's what I thought. You see that? Now what it is a TV camera, right? You guys don't have to protect me from that, do you?" No, look, Hayes, we want to get you off the street. There could be...
I tell you, that guy was alone up there. There isn't anybody else to worry about, and I'm going to talk to these TV guys because I'm a free citizen.
You're a minor, the plainclothesman began hesitantly, and we have to...
That's a lot of bull. Here.
He reached beyond the plainclothesman and grabbed the microphone.
See? No trouble.
Several people standing nearby applauded. The plainclothesman glanced uncertainly around. He began, "We don't want you giving..."
"What happened in there?"
someone shouted.
"A lot,"
Hayes shouted back.
"Did you see that guy shooting?" "Well, I saw it all, man. Cold cocked the guy, I did."
He peered at the camera.
"I'm Bob Hayes, and I saw it all. I'm here to tell you. Bob Hayes from Thomas Jefferson High."
"How many shots were fired?" an off-camera voice asked, trying to get Hayes on the track of the story.
"Three. I was walking down the hall outside when I heard the first one. Guy downstairs was eating lunch, and he sent me up to get some magazines they had stored up there. So I'm looking for him, and I hear this loud noise."
Hayes paused, plainly enjoying this.
"Yeah?"
someone said.
"I knew it was a rifle right off. So I opened this door where it came from. I see these chicken bones on a carton, like somebody's having lunch. Then I see this guy crouched down and pointing this rifle out the window. He had it on the sill to brace it. He was leaning on some cartons, too."
"That was Oswald?"
"That's what these guys said his name was, and me, I didn't ask."
Hayes grinned. Someone laughed.
"I start over toward this guy, and boom, he fires again. I can hear somebody yelling outside. I didn't think about it. I just went for him. Dove over this crate and slammed into him. Just then, the rifle goes off again just as I hit him. I used to play some football, you know, and I know how to take a guy out."
"You got the rifle away from him?" Hayes grinned again.
"Hell no, man. I mashed him up against the windowsill. Then I leaned back to get some room, and I gave him a good one upside the head. He forgot all about that rifle right then. So I hit him again, and he went all glassy-eyed. His number was up, man."
"He was out cold?"
"Sure was. I do good work, fella."
"Then the police arrived."
"Yeah, once this guy was out, I looked out the window. I saw all these cops looking up at me. Waved to them and called down to tell them where I was. They got up there right away."
"Could you see the President's Lincoln speeding away?"
"Well, I didn't know there was any president. Just a lot of traffic, that's all. Some kind of parade, I thought. For Thanksgiving or something, you know. I came down here because Mr. Aiken, our physics teacher, sent me on down."
The crowd around Hayes was utterly silent. The boy was a born performer, beaming straight into the camera and playing to the audience. The off-camera questioner asked, "You realize that you may have prevented a successful attempt on the life of the..."
"Yeah, that's amazing. Great, but, you know, I didn't have any idea about that. Didn't even know he was in town. Would have gone downstairs to see him and Jackie if I'd known."
"You had not seen Oswald before? You had no sign that he had a rifle and..."
"Look, like I said, I was down here to get some magazines. Mr. Aiken is doing this special 2-day extra credit project in our college-level physics course, the PST one. It's on the stuff in this magazine, Senior Scholastic. Mr. Aiken, he had me come down here to get him for the class this afternoon.
There's something about, you know, this signal from the future and the shots. How many of them hit?"
"Hit what?"
"The president."
"Hell, I don't know. He got off two of them okay. I socked him good just before the third."
Hayes grinned, looking around, beaming. The plainclothesman tugged at his arm. "I believe that's enough, Mr. Hayes," he said, using another tactic. "There will be a press conference later."
"Oh, yeah,"
Hayes said affably. His momentum was spent for the moment. He was still transfixed by being the center of attention.
"Yeah, I'll tell it all later."
More shouted questions. A blur of motion as the police formed a wedge for Hayes. Clicking of cameras. Calls to clear the way. A rumble as a motorcycle started. Flickering images of men in overcoats pushing, mouths twisted. Gordon blinked, and for a moment he seemed to lose his balance. Senior Scholastic. The rec room swam in its pale, musty light. Then Cronkite was talking again in that reedy voice. At Parkland Memorial Hospital, a brief press conference had just concluded while Hayes was speaking. Malcolm Kilduff, assistant press secretary to the president, had described the wound. A bullet had entered the lower back of the president's neck. It had passed through and left a small exit wound. The entry wound was larger and bled freely. The president had received several pints of ORH-negative blood, as well as 300 milligrams hydrocortisone intravenously. At first, the attending physicians had inserted a tube to clear the president's breathing passage. This failed. The senior physician, Michael Cosgrove, elected to perform a tracheotomy. This took 5 minutes. Lactated Ringer's solution, a modified saline solution, was fed into the right leg via catheter. The president began breathing well, though he was still in coma. His dilated eyes were open and staring directly into a glaring fluorescent lamp overhead. A nasogastric tube was thrust through Kennedy's nose and fitted behind his trachea to clear away possible sources of nausea in his stomach. Bilateral chest tubes were placed in both chest pleural spaces to suck out damaged tissue and prevent lung collapse. The president's heartbeat was weak but regular. The exit wound was treated first, since the president was on his back. Three doctors then rolled the body onto its side. The entry wound gaped, larger than the exit wound by more than twice, and was the principal point of blood loss. It was treated without difficulty. Kennedy was still in trauma room number one of Parkland as Kilduff spoke. His condition appeared stable. There was no apparent damage to the brain. His right lung was bruised, his windpipe was ripped apart. It appeared that, barring complications, he would live. Mrs. Kennedy was not hit. Governor Connolly was in critical condition. The vice president was not hit. The attending physicians could make no comment on the number of shots fired. It was clear, however, that only one bullet had struck the president. The crowd around the television murmured and stirred. The sensation of lightness and pressing heat had gone. Objects no longer swayed as though seen underwater, refracted. Gordon shouldered his way through the close-packed students. Speculations buzzed around him. He slid aside the glass door to the wooden deck and stepped through. Without thinking, he vaulted over the railing and out onto the parking lot. He got his running gear out of the trunk of the Chevy. He changed in the nearby men's room. In shorts and tennis shoes, he looked as young as many of the students still flocking to the rec room in search of news. He felt an airy sense of liberation and a humming, random energy, almost pleasurable. He did not want to think just now. He began to run on the flat, watery sand. A steady breeze came in, blowing strands of black hair across his eyes. He ran with his head down, watching his feet strike. When his heel hit the sand, a pale circle leaped into being as the water rushed out, driven by the impact. The beach hardened under each step, upholding him, and dissolved back to a gray slate sameness behind him. A helicopter passed, whoop, 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 overhead. He skirted the town and ran through Crescent Coves, heading south until he reached Nautilus Street. Penny was grading papers. He told her the news. She wanted to turn on the radio, learn more, but he tugged her away. Reluctantly, she went with him. They went to the beach and walked south. Neither spoke. Penny fidgeted, face cloudy. The sea breeze scuffed the tops from the white caps and furled a banner of foam from each. Gordon looked at them and thought about them coming across the Pacific, driven by tides and winds. They were shallow out in the ocean and moved fast. As they neared the land, the seabed reared up beneath them and they deepened and slowed. Coming in, a wave moved faster at the top than at the bottom, and they toppled forward, the energy from out of Asia churning them into turbulence. Penny called to him. She was already charging into the shallows. He followed. It was the first time he had tried this, but that did not matter. They swam out beyond the waves and waited for the next big one to come in. It moved with stately slowness. The dark blue line thickened and rose, and Gordon looked at it and estimated where it would break. He pulled forward, stroking fast and kicking. Penny was ahead. He felt something picking him up, and the water ahead fell away. A rushing sound, and he moved faster. He flung out his arms and leaned to the left. Spray hazed his eyes. He blinked. He cut down the face of the wave, cupped in a wall of water, curling and churning toward the shore.
Chapter 45, 1998. John Renfrew worked through the night. He had the temporary power supply going, and he was damned if he'd stopped while the fuel held out. If he'd stopped, he couldn't be sure of getting it started again. Better to go on and see what would happen. Then he could have no regrets. He grimaced. See what would happen, or had happened. Or could happen. Human language did not fit the physics. There was no tense of the verb to be that reflected the looping sense of time. No way to turn the language on the pivot of physics, to apply a torque that would make the paradoxes dissolve into an ordered cycle, endlessly turning. He had let the technicians go. They were needed at home. Outside, on the cotton footpath, no bicycles, no movement. Families were home, tending the ill, or else had fled to the countryside. He felt a twinge of the dysentery that had come in the night, a brush with the gnawing stuff from the clouds, he guessed. He'd been drinking from a store of bottled fruit drinks he'd found in the cafeteria and eating packaged foods. For 2 days he'd been here, alone, not pausing to go home for a change of clothes. The world as he had lived in it was closing down. That much was clear from the windows of the lab. Since early morning, a plume of oily smoke had filled upwards in the distance. Obviously, no one was trying to put it out. He tuned the apparatus gingerly. Tap, tap. Tap, tap. The tachyon noise level remained constant. He'd been transmitting the new message about the neurojacket process for days now, mixing it with the RA and DEC monotony. Peterson had phoned new biological sentences in from his London office. The man had sounded strained and hurried. The content of the message, as nearly as Renfrew could understand it, explained why. If the California group was right, this thing could spread through the cloud seed mechanism with blinding speed. Renfrew tapped patiently on his Morse key, hoping he had the focusing right. It was so bloody difficult to know if you had the rig aimed. A slight error in targeting the beam put it at the wrong X, and thus at the wrong T. He had got through once. That they'd learned from Peterson's bank vault. But how could he check now, if the pulsing coils were a microsecond slow, or the fringing fields throwing the beam a degree to the left? He had only his sandy-eyed calibrations to trust. He was adrift here, in a world where T was time, and T was brine. An X for space, an X for the unknown, floated in the air before him, a passing pattern. He shook himself. The lab stool pinched his buttocks. He had less fat there now. Must have lost weight. Have to put on some extra ballast. Yes. Tap, tap, tap. Out went the Morse cadences. Tap, tap. Maybe the weight loss explained why the room rippled and stretched as he watched. Christ, he was tired. One anger welled up in him. He'd been tap-tap-tapping out biological stuff and coordinates and a lot, all impersonal, and he was sure of it now, in the end, all useless. Bloody boring it was. He reached over and took up the identifying passage he'd been transmitting regularly, and began sending it again. But this time, he added a few comments of his own about how this whole thing got started, and Markham's ideas, and Peterson, the stiff-faced bastard, and the lot, all the way up to Markham's crash. It felt good to get it all down, pushing the words out in Morse as he thought of them. He told it in ordinary sentences, not the clipped telegraph style they'd adopted for compressing the biological information. It was a relief to tell it, really. The whole sudding thing was pointless. The beam was pouring down some unsuspected cosmic rattle anyway, so why not enjoy this last shot? Tap, tap. Here's my life story, mate, written on the head of a pin. Tap, tap. Into the void. Tap, tap. But after a while, the momentum left him and he stopped. His shoulders sagged. The scope screen rippled and the tachyon noise level rose. Renfrew peered at it. Tap, tap. On impulse, he flipped off the transmitting switch. The pass be damned for a moment. He watched the scramble of curves arc and intersect, dancing. For brief snatches of time, the noise resolved into these snakings across the screen. Signals, clearly. Someone else was transmitting. Regular jolts of waveforms, evenly spaced. Renfrew copied them. Attempt contact from 2,349, intact. And a blur of noise again, swallowing all. English. Somebody sending in English from the year 2,349? Perhaps. Or maybe with tachyons in the 234.9 kilovolt range. Or maybe it was a fluke. A sport. Renfrew slurped cold coffee. He had made a thermos days ago and forgotten it. He hoped the water was okay. The coffee hadn't the dog's fur flavour he remembered, more like scorched earth. He shrugged and drank it without thinking further. He felt his brow. Sweat. A fever. A strange distant mutter came to him. Voices. He went to look. Surprised at his weakness, at the lurking ache in his ankles and thighs. Should get more exercise, he thought automatically, and then laughed. Scuffling noises. Had they heard him? He lurched down a corridor, but there was no one about. Only the sound of the wind. That and the gritty scraping of his own shoes on the bare concrete. He went back and stared at the scope. His throat burned. He tried to think calmly and cleanly about what Markham had said so long ago. The micro-universes were not like black holes, not in the sense that inside them all matter was compressed into infinite densities. Instead, their average density was a reasonable number, though higher than ours. They had formed in the early moments of the universe and had been forever isolated, living out micro-lives inside a folded geometry. Wickham's new field equation showed they were out there, between the clusters of galaxies. An X and a T we cannot see, he thought, apart from me and thee. Now there was a literary flourish for you, worthy of the last edition of the Times, the very last edition. Abruptly he sat, feeling dizzy, an ache behind his eyes spreading. Matter was swallowed into the net of space-time of differential geometries. G times N. A tachyon would wing out of the knots, a free phoenix, its flight ordained by the squiggles and jots of Markham and Wickham. Renfrew shivered as the cold seeped into him. Another set of bursts. He scribbled them on a pad. The scratching pen cut the silence. Meant enhance resonance structure by tuning to sideband carrier. And then the sea of noise again. The waves last. This all meant something to someone, but who? Where? When? Another. Angst, Wirruth, Zimzum Dorthdint, Aswirru, Aswirrut. Wrong language. A code from across the galaxy, from across the universe. This apparatus opened up communications with everywhere, everywhen, and instantly. Talk to the stars. Talk to the compressed beings inside a dot of space. A telegram from Andromeda would take less time than one from London. Tachyon sleeted through the laboratory, through Renfrew, bringing word. It was within their grasp, if only they had time. He shook his head. All form and structure was eroded by the overlapping of many voices. A chorus. Everyone was talking at once, and no one could hear. The roughing pumps coughed. Tachyons of size 10 to the 13th power centimeters were flashing across whole universes, across 10 to the 28th power centimeters of cooling matter, in less time than Renfrew's eye took to absorb a photon of the pale laboratory light. All distances and times were wound in upon each other, singularities sucking up the stuff of creation. Event horizons rippled and worlds coiled into worlds. There were voices in this room, voices clamoring, touching. Renfrew stood up and suddenly clutched at a scope mount for support. Christ, the fever. It clawed at him, ran glowing smoke fingers through his mind. Attempt contact from 2349. All thought of reaching the past was gone now, he realized, blinking. The room veered, then righted itself. With Markham gone and the Wiccan woman missing for days, there was no longer even any hope of understanding what had happened. Casualty's leaden hand would win out. The soothing human world of flowing time would go on, a sphinx yielding none of her secrets. An infinite series of grandfathers who would live out their lives safe from Renfrew. Attempt contact. The scope sputtered again. But unless he knew where and when they were, there was no hope of answering. Hello, 2349. Hello out there. This is 1998. An X and a T in your memory. Hello. Attempt contact. Renfrew smiled with flinty irony. Whispers came flitting, embedding soft words of tomorrow in the idiom. Someone was there. Someone brought hope. The room was cold. Renfrew huddled by his instruments, perspiring, peering at the bursts of waves. He was like a South Sea Islander, watching the airplanes draw their stately lines across the sky, unable to shout up to them. I am here. Hello, 2349. Hello. He was trying a modification of the signal correlator when the lights winked out. Utter blackness rushed in. The distant generator rattled and chugged into silence. It took a long time to feel his way out and into the light. It was a bleak grey noon, but he didn't notice. It was enough to be outside. He could hear no sound from Cambridge at all. The breeze carried a sour tang. No birds, no aircraft. He walked south towards Grantchester. He looked back once at the low square profile of the cab, and in the diffused light, he raised a hand to it. He thought of the nested universes, onion skin within onion skin. Leaning back, head swimming, he peered at the clouds, once so benign a sight. Above that cloak was the galaxy, a great swarm of coloured lights turning with majestic slowness in the great night. Then he looked down at the bumpy, worn footpath and felt a great weight lift from him. For so long now he had been transfixed by the past. It had deadened him to this real world around him. He knew now, without knowing quite how he knew, that it was forever lost. Rather than feeling despair, he was elated. Free! Marjorie lay up ahead, no doubt, frightened to be alone. He remembered her preserves on the uncompromising straight shelving, and smiled. They could eat those for some time, have some easy meals together, as they did in the days before the children. They would soon have to go to the countryside and get Johnny and Nicky, of course. Puffing slightly, his head clearing, He walked along the deserted path. There was really quite a lot ahead to do when you thought about it.
Chapter 46, October 28, 1974. He walked from his hotel on Connecticut Avenue. The reception was to be a buffet lunch, the letter said, so Gordon had slept in until 11. He had long ago learned that on short trips to the east it was best to grant nothing to the myth of time zones and keep to his western schedule. Invariably, this fit the demands on an out-of-town visitor anyway, since such occasions were excuses for lingering over sauce-drenched entrees in expensive restaurants, followed by earnest, "Now that we're away from the office, I can speak frankly," revelations over several cups of coffee, and then late-night stumblings to bed. Arising at 10 the next morning seldom got into the NSF or AEC later than the executives themselves, since he ate no breakfast. He tramped through the city zoo. It was more or less along the way. Yellow canine eyes followed him, contemplating the results if the bars were suddenly lifted. Chimps swung in pendulum strokes on an unending circuit of their cramped universe. The natural world was a pocket here, amid distant honks and looming square profiles of sour brown brick. Gordon savored the clammy fullness of the breeze that had tunneled its way up from the Potomac. He welcomed this traveler's brush with the seasons, punctuations to the extended sentences of the months, a welcome relief from California's monotonous excellence. He had first come here with his mother and father. That tourist's orbit was now a dim set of memories from a corner of his pre-adolescence, the period of life that he supposed was everybody's golden age. He remembered being awed at the sleek white glow of the Washington Monument and the White House. For years afterward, he was certain these solemn edifices were what was meant when his grammar school class sang America and chorused about alabaster majesties. "The country, it really begins in Washington," his mother had said, not forgetting to add the pedagogical D.C. so that her son would never confuse it with the state. And Gordon, towed through the list of historic shrines, saw what she meant. Beyond the Frenchified design of the city center lay a rural park, land that breathed of Jefferson and tree-traced boulevards. To him, Washington had ever since been the entranceway to a vast republic where crops sprouted under a wasp sun. There, blue-eyed blondes drove yellow roadsters that left dust plumes on the open roads as they roared from one country fair to the next. Women won prizes for strawberry preserves, and men drank watery beer and kissed girls who had been struck from the template of Doris Day. He had gazed upward at the spirit of St. Louis, hanging like a paralyzed moth in the Smithsonian, and wondered how a cornhusker city, without a single good college in it, his mother sniffed, could flap wings and scoot aloft. Gordon thrust his hands into his pockets for warmth and walked. The corners of his mouth perked up in an airy mirth. He had learned a lot about the huge country beyond Washington, most of it from Penny. Their mutual abrasions had healed over in the aftermath of 1963, and they had found again the persistent chemistry that had first drawn them into their mutual bound orbits, circles centered on a point midway between them. The thing between them was not a geometric dot, but rather a small sun, igniting between them a passion Gordon felt was deeper than anything that had happened to him before. They were married in late 1964. Her father, just plain Jack, put on a massive wedding, glittery and champagne-steeped. Penny wore the traditional white. She made a downward-turning leer whenever anyone mentioned it. She had come with him to Washington that winter when he was making his first big presentation to the NSF for a major grant of his own. His talk went well, and Penny fell in love with the National Gallery, going every day to see the Vermeers. Together they ate shellfish with luminaries from the NSF and strolled down from the Congressional Dome to the Lincoln Monument. They did not mind the raw, cold damp then. It went with the scenery. Everything had seemed to go with everything else. Gordon checked the address and found that he had another block to go. He had always been intrigued by the contrasts of Washington. This busy street brimmed with its own importance, yet intersecting it were thinner avenues of small shops, decaying houses, and corner grocery stores. Old black men leaned in doorways, their large brown eyes surveying the tax-funded bustle. Gordon waved to one, and, turning a corner, discovered a mammoth courtyard. It had the austere French style of 1950s government classical, with conical evergreens standing like sentries at the abrupt, uncompromising corners. Regimented bushes led the eye, willing or not, into remorseless perspectives. Well, he thought, blocky and self-important architecture or no, this was it. He teetered back on his heels to look. Granite facings led upward into a bland sky. He took his hands out of his pockets and brushed hair back from his eyes. Already there was the giveaway thinning of the crown. He knew, sure sign, that his father's baldness would find echo in his own 40s.
This ends side 1 of cassette 11. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.